kind of pleasure that arises from breaking rules. The person likes to do what he likes to do. And as a result of that, he later has to live with that which he does not like to live with, the consequences of his own conduct. Actually, we are all tempted continuously, and will be as long as we live. There will never be a moment when the opportunity to be angry, disappointed, or disillusioned will not arise in our environment. If, however, we build upon this, we will gradually settle down to an acidity which we can no longer endure. So off we go to get clinical help. But actually, the problem can be solved right inside of ourselves. So the next time the problem arises, to commit any action that requires censorship, put the censorship of the coordinator over it. Control it. The next time you have the opportunity to disparage someone, put the coordinator over it. And remember the words of Jesus and the dead dog. When the apostles wanted to know why the master looked so sadly at the dog, its body, the carcass that was rotting by the roadside, Jesus answered, "Pearls are not whiter than its teeth." This is not in the Bible, for it's probably a good reason. It does not support exactly what theology wants or would like to support. But it points out one thing, that if we have the sufficient depth of insight within ourselves, we can find something good to think about, something good to talk about, something good to share with almost anything and anyone that lives. The problem then is to pick up this point quickly. And when you're just about ready to make a destructive or negative remark, let the coordinator step in. Now, how do we strengthen the coordinator? That's a pretty good question. We all have it, just as surely as we have hands and feet. We have the coordinator as surely as we have eyes and fingers to touch and handle things. It's there, but it has been allowed to languish. It has been allowed to fail to become dominant, because it requires a kind of strength. Weakness will never win. There's a great difference between weakness and meekness. Meekness is very healthy. Weakness is very unhealthy. So weakness is that which causes us to keep on doing the things we want to do, regardless of their effect upon ourselves or other people. These kind of weaknesses break homes every day. These kind of weaknesses turn orphans and the parentless children out onto society. These weaknesses all arise from the impulse to do exactly as we please, regardless of consequences. And we assume that when we do this, we are happy. For happiness is born upon freedom. Now, freedom is a nice word, but it is used badly. Freedom is not license. Freedom is not the right to do as you please. Freedom is the privilege we all have, the tremendous privilege of free will. Each of us can please to do that which is right. This is the supreme example of freedom. We are not slaves who have to make the mistakes of others. We are free to make our own mistakes, and have made a great deal of this particular point of view. We have taken it and tried to live by it. Now, what can we use to strengthen the coordinator? Obviously, if we were thinking right, and if we were seeing correctly, and the senses were all functioning normally, we would be right and do right. Therefore, there are mistakes in our own attitudes which constantly prevent us from achieving control over our own lives. Well, one of the things we have to do is to find out where strength does lie. In most cases, the average person has never had a sincere experience of moral strength. Some have, and it has made them the heroes of the world. But to the most people, there is a sense of weakness. Instead of saying, "I can do what I should," the voice seems to say, "I can't do what I should." We cannot rise above weaknesses in ourselves. Now, where are we going to find strength larger and greater than weakness? Mankind has been working on this problem since the beginning of time. And the only answer that apparently has been satisfactory up to now has been religion. Religion is something that has become the ever-present help in time of trouble when we wanted to do right. Religion has been a belief in the supremacy of right, in the absolute power of good. And religion takes the attitude, in particularly Oriental religions, that the whole universal plan is created and maintained to bring to each individual the realization of faith. The person must have a source of strength greater than himself. In antiquity, the child turned to the parent as a source of strength. The average person turned to the temple as a source of strength. But everywhere, always, there had to be some power strong enough and great enough to lead the individual into the fulfillment of his own life. This being true, we have it now today as part of our philosophy of existence, that the great truth is that God and one is a majority, that in some way God now doesn't represent a person. God represents a principle of integrity. God manifests as the moral power within the individual to do what is right. It is that which is forever sustaining the best. But in our daily living, we have given it very little opportunity to express itself in that way. We have thought of deity, for the most part, as a kind of sovereign over us, and like physical sovereigns, primarily concerned with the divine work itself or the establishment of its own empires. Actually, however, nearly every great mystic, nearly everyone who has risen above the level of the commonplace and the fields of service, integration, self-sacrifice, and forgiveness, has been to some degree a mystic, has been to some degree under the influence of a powerful, benign faith. These things all point out the fact that today, perhaps, most people could handle their own affairs better if they did have faith in a supreme power. For instance, if they looked for authority, not in terms of wealth or political power, but in terms of integrity or universal power, they would be able to make many decisions that are now beyond them. We are likely to assume today that the great monopoly, the great industrial complex, the wealth of great fortunes, great industrial enterprises, that these are the big things, that these are the things upon which our opinions must be built. This is completely false. We should know this by now, when half the great corporations of the world are in debt over their heads and will never pay off. Actually, we have put our faith upon physical wealth, power, authority, station, as being able to protect us. And yet not all the wealth in the whole world will not protect us from one living, vital bacteria. We are in a universe in which what we have trusted is not trustworthy. So we have to find that out, and we do it by using the faculties of sight and hearing, particularly, to know what is happening. But if we see these things and still remain the same, then the coordinator is not developed to the degree that is necessary to lead us into a better way of life. So we must use the faculties that we have to censor our own conduct, to recognize what is necessary and what is next, and continue to live according to the best that we know. We also realize that the moment we begin to strengthen these inner resources of character, we find that they grow rather rapidly, and that the first step is always the most difficult, and that after that we'll discover that each improvement in ourselves is reflected by a betterment of our social relationships and helps us to live in a better world. Now, we won't all gain this at once, But we will all gain something if we begin to use the faculties that we possess. The great inspiration is there. We are all inspired by a common misery. We are all looking for the answer to things that hurt. We are looking for cures to physical ailments. We are looking for cures to moral and emotional stress and vice. We know definitely from the sciences around us, even in the material world, that many cases of sorrow, misery, and pain are simply due to wrong living. We know that hospitals are filled with people who really did not need to be there, but through intemperances and so forth, they gradually destroyed their physical resources. These could have been saved if they had thought and allowed character and strength to lead them away from their bad habits. But if they use strength to support the bad habit, then the trouble is complete. So we say if a person really wants to be a personal psychiatrist or psychologist over their own conduct, that they can start with little problems that come along. We sometimes don't realize a mistake until a little while after we make it. But we can, of course, keep a sort of psychological diary over this. Now, the psychologist that we pay $50 an hour to or something is scribbling a few notes as he goes along to see what he can do to put together some kind of a pattern for us. We can scribble our own notes. We can have a notepad near handy or in the purse or pocket in which we can say at 2 o'clock, I was rather nasty to someone. Now, I was mad at the time. I was very much put out. I felt that I'd been very, very badly treated. So, I just kind of nursed this grievance. 4 o'clock the next day, I found out that I'd been mistaken in my point of view. That I shouldn't have taken that attitude, that the other person believed he was right and was trying to be helpful. So, then we sit down and we consult these things. Here's an example of something. This friend of ours happened to catch us one afternoon when we were driving a car with about 3 or 4 too many drinks. He said, look, don't do this. Stop it. You should not drive a car when you're under alcohol. And, of course, the alcoholic was duly indignant. He wasn't under alcohol. He was as sober as a judge, only he didn't know where he was. The answer to that was he hated the man who said it to him. Well, after he had paid the fine for driving under influence of alcohol and had his license suspended, this man he turned away from as a gabby old gentleman was really his friend, was trying to help him. And we never know how the Lord is going to speak. He sometimes talks to us with people we don't even know. But always, if there's a message, take it. If there's no message, forget it. Now, on another occasion, we'll say the situation is different. In another occasion, we are actually damaged by another person. We have betrayed them, or we have done something that was very bad for them. And the sufferer has a feeling of great indignation. I know a case in which indignation like this lasted for 60 years. The person never spoke again to the individual who had injured them. Now, the truth of the matter was the individual had injured them. But that injury took about 15 minutes 60 years ago. And the rest of the 60 years was spent remembering it. And the more their memory strengthened, the more the trouble grew. And this memory determined and distorted the life of that remembering person for years. The whole of life was made less desirable by a nasty memory. Now, that memory was probably true. But we are warned in the sacred writings to do good to those who most certainly do evil to us. And we must definitely forgive our enemies. Now, forgiving our enemies is quite a trick for some people. They just can't make it. They feel that their grievance is something that they did not deserve. Therefore, they have a right to resent and continue to resent the person who thus offended them. This is be all true, but every major faith of the world and most of the better philosophies all agree that the only answer is to forget and forgive. Now we must get some kind of a moral integrity into ourselves and realize that the first thing that happened, the other person hurt us, and for the rest of our lives we hurt ourselves. Therefore, transmute and try to understand the situation. Look back very carefully, and you may find considerable foundation for forgiveness. In the big excitement of feeling mad and bad about the whole thing, very often we forget what we contributed to our own misfortune, that we did things that helped to make that injury likely, probable, and inevitable, that we were not guiltless in it. The guilt consisted in the fact that maybe somebody injured us before we got the chance to injure them, which was also part of the plan. There are all kinds of factors, but they all add up to one thing, that a person who wants to stay away from the psychiatrist must learn to get over all forms of grudges, must get out of the system those things which have a tendency to be unpleasant. Now, this does not mean that we must actually go back and live with people who have hurt us. The main problem is they don't probably want to live with us either. But the point is we must stop living with the ghosts of these persons inside ourselves. We must forgive them if we feel that they have injured us. We must try to understand the lesson to ourselves. How do we become richer and more complete as persons as a result of solving a grievance? Why is solving a grievance the basis of personal growth and strength? We grow by what we forgive, and we get weaker by what we hold on to, if it's negative and destructive. So we take all the different things that happen to us in life, and we try to make them fit into a pattern, to find out, if we can, why we are frustrated. One of the major problems of today, of course, it lies in the field of matrimony. There are a great many unhappy homes. There are a great many miseries in these fields. Where a condition arises in which some form of decision is obviously necessary, we must try to make such decisions as will gradually strengthen our own inner insight. We are not expected to endure the impossible, but we are also expected to learn something even from that which we cannot endure. Everywhere there is something to be learned by every instance in life. There is something to be learned when we are in a car wreck. There is something to be learned when we lose a job. In everything there is something that must help us to rise above the commonplace reactions of individuals who simply pout and gloom their way through the years. We can't afford this type of thing. So if you are thinking a little bit of going to psychologists to find out how your stations are at the moment, first ask yourself, what do you really love in this world that is more important than yourself? What is it that you would like to be which would be of greater benefit to other people? Why do you want to advance in your estate? Do you want more money? Then that is a very weak payment. The great payment for experience is not to accumulate wealth, but to accumulate insight, understanding, tolerance, kindness, and love of humanity. Now, it may well be that in the course of your life, you're never going to do anything exceedingly spectacular. Perhaps you are not going to rise and lead nations to freedom. But you are going to have the opportunity to go out of this life when the time comes in a better condition of personal growth than you brought with you when you came. We must learn something out of living. Unless we learn, there is no living. Life is not simply a veil of circumstances. It is a pattern of projects and purposes. Life is something that we have to use to grow. It is the supreme opportunity to outgrow ourselves, to build a new foundation of character. When we leave here, that's all we can take with us anyway. We cannot take with us anything except the integrities which have become real and vital in our own lives. When we understand this, we will escape a great many of the imperfections and problems that beset most people. Ambition is an interesting thing. Ambition is something that makes us want to do more, to have more, to ascend the ladder of social preferences, to become a leader, to gain wealth, to become capable of dominating, influencing, and controlling other people. Perhaps the highest end of ambition is dictatorship, an imperial relationship with the rest of life. Now, most people consider ambition a virtue. They think that if the individual is lacking in ambition and doesn't want to be the president of the society or organization to which he belongs, who does not wish to be the richest man in his community, if he doesn't have these kind of attitudes, he is doomed to failure. He'll never succeed because he doesn't have the grit and wary temperament. Against ambition, which is nearly always a heartbreaker, there are other things to consider. Let the ambitious person for a moment say to himself, I am 30 and I am ambitious. I want to be the head of the corporation. Then say to himself, use your eyes, which are among the keys of wisdom, and your ears, which tell much, and look at the present head of this organization. He worked through until he was 40 or 45 or 50, and finally he got the job that you now hope to have someday. If he is fortunate beyond all normal expectancy, he may hold that job till retirement. In other words, out of a lifetime of effort, he may be the chief executive for 5 or 10 years. Then he is going to retire. He will be presented with a grandfather's clock with chimes and live from there on his pension. He will probably be welcome to drop in occasionally and shake hands with a man who worked for years to take his place. This is success. This is the big thing. This is what causes an individual to give up family, friends, neglect his children, neglect the improvement of his inner life, or for what? For 10 years and a swimming pool. And of course, many of the people who have swimming pools do not know how to swim, which is another unfortunate thing, so they settle for a jacuzzi. All of this is part of something you should see in yourself and see what you're doing and see how much better you might have been had your life been centered upon something else. Ambitions are competitive, but aspirations are not. No matter how much you gain, how far you advance by aspiration, you injure no other human being. You take no job from anyone. Because what you are trying to do is grow. And growth is the release of the best part of yourself. You may never be the president of the corporation, but then you will never be also the one who has to retire and sit around playing golf for the rest of his life. Your aspirations are those that make you want to be better, to know more, to serve better, to be more understanding of life, to increase your knowledge and skill in those areas which endure. In other words, aspiration helps you to build up a treasure that moths cannot destroy nor time corrode. Aspiration is to leave this world a greater human being than you were when you came here. And being a greater human being, you will have discovered that this greatness has its perfect fulfillment in humility. That instead of thinking of how great you are, the greater you will become as you think how little you know and how little you can do in the presence of the infinite potential of existence. So in one way or another, you can put your life in order. you can try to understand people who disagree with you. Today we have a very serious problem in the world on religion. Religion is something very necessary. And most religion admit that religion is very necessary. And yet each religion is desperately afraid that some other faith will compete with it, that some other faith will get some privilege, or that that which is not true will overwhelm that which is true. And anything that believes that is untrue itself. So that instead of working together to give humanity the example of a dedicated service of principles, these faiths become competitive. They become ambitious. They have ambition to greater number, greater and more magnificent churches and shrines, when their real purpose is to aspire to be of greater service to living things. So religion gets into trouble because it competes. The individual gets into trouble in his own opinions because they compete. There is very little difference between an individual who differs on the nature of the Holy Trinity and the individual who differs as to which team of baseball players is the best. They will fight over these things. Each one has his own opinions. And opinions are truly, as Epicurus says, a falling sickness of the reason. Everyone's opinions are invalid unless they arise from the coordination of all available knowledge and resource. The individual, even if he is correct, should be correct modestly and with no intention to discourage, disparage, or hurt someone else. So out of all these things, we come to the needs for a sort of kindly life. It doesn't have to be spectacular. We're not expected to give up every mistake we make. We cannot also lose every grudge we are still desperately clinging to. But we can reduce by degrees their authority over our consciousness. We can come more and more into the light of common sense, which is the testimony held in common by the senses. Bad judgment is always due to a deformity in the sensory patterns. A bad judgment is due to the acceptance of an untruth as true. And once this untruth is accepted, all superstructures of error can be built upon it. If you have a false hypothesis, all that comes from it is necessarily deformed. And most people live with a false hypothesis on some subjects. And these subjects are the areas where their unhappiness, where their conflicts, and where their bitterness can most often arise. It is just a case where the individual can, with common sense, obtain a level of function that is highly desirable. Most people who are very nervous today are also infirm physically. Something is wrong on the health level. Their digestion is bad, and an enemy can ruin your digestion. An adversary of some kind is more deadly than a bacillus. Actually, a prejudice can actually destroy the function of your liver, and a nursed grievance can open you to a great many contagious or infectious diseases. The moment we break the laws of mental and emotional health, we begin to transgress physical proprieties. Today we have an opportunity to see just what all these extremes add up to. Everyone now is a health seeker. Everyone wants to be healthy. Why? Largely so that he continue to make the mistakes he's always made. He just wants to be stronger when he does things badly. Also, in a desperate effort to take care of symptoms, he goes on various diets. He says, maybe the reason I don't care for my neighbor is because I don't have enough protein. So first thing you know, chemicals and diet supplements become potential sources of happiness. They are not a source of happiness. They're a source of heavy expense. That's what they are. And that the expense is getting heavier every day. It's true that we do need to watch a proper diet. But proper health depends upon the proper function of the five coordinators. The various sensory perceptions must be in harmony in order that the body can function properly. Anarchy starts in the body the moment it starts in the mind of the person who owns the body. Almost every intemperance of the body is symbolic of a psychological intemperance within the individual. If he was well adjusted, his health would improve, unless he has gone so far that he has wrecked most of his health. One of the main problems of health problems is elimination. And probably it is the most common ailment in the health pattern today. And physical elimination is something that everyone is trying desperately to regulate. But to get the proper physical elimination, it is also very necessary to have mental and emotional elimination. We have to get out of the system the refuse of useless thinking. We have to get rid of toxins which have built up, and very largely as the result of not regulating eliminations, we not only allow these poisons to accumulate in the body, but by not regulating our mental problems, we allow psychic and psychological toxins to accumulate in the body. And the lack of physical elimination is nearly always associated with holding on to mental or emotional attitudes which are unhealthy. And we know that a healthy, happy, ordinated person, a person who is in a good internal balance, will have very few needs for supplementary nutrition unless they're in a particularly unhealthy atmosphere. Always we know that the emotional factors affect the physical. There is no question in the world that the whole cycle of physical ailments, as some of the homeopathic physicians have realized, namely that these ailments arise according to the order of the 12 zodiacal signs, and that 12 basic homeopathic sal salts are created or organized to assist the balancing of these factors. That actually the individual must control the effects of the cosmos upon himself if he expects to be healthy. So every one of us is a little solar system. We have our planets, we have our elements, we have our worlds, and these are constantly forming patterns. We are having our own earthquakes and volcanic eruptions. We are having everything you can think of. But if we organize the coordinator, if we put the leader of ourselves in the position of honorable and honest leadership, we will find that largely the body will continue to improve. We will have longer life and enjoy it better. And when we do find it time to depart from here, we will leave with a much higher rating for intelligence. We will leave truly improved by the fact we were here. We will leave wiser and better prepared for the future. If life as we see it here was the end of all, there would be no reason actually for anything. If this is the end, there is no reason why we should do anything except vegetate. But actually, man was not made to vegetate. Man was not made to go through the vicissitudes of 60, 70, 80, 90 years in this world and then have nothing to show for it. And if there is nothing that survives death, there is nothing to show for it. The only answer that seems reasonable is that we are all in a business relationship with an invisible cause of ourselves. Behind the body is the true manager of our lives. And it is this internal, eternal principle behind us that we must serve, that we must please, that we must obey. and to do these things, we must live up to the reason for our own existence. There's no doubt in the world that we need counseling, but we need to counsel ourselves. We need to be the person who investigates ourselves for the reason that no one else can possibly know us as well as we do. You can spend a fortune trying to share with some physician all the secrets of your life, but if you are an ordinary person, you will carefully avoid the things that you most need to discuss. The real situation will remain encapsulated. I know one case, a very admirable worker in the field, who told me one day, he said, many of his patients, those in the deepest trouble, can come to him twice a week for a year or 2 years and never tell the truth. They are not going to tell the real cause, because if they tell that, they have to admit that they are wrong. They have to admit that they have been foolish, stupid, selfish, or unreasonable. They have to admit that they sacrificed integrity for some childish whim. And they won't do this. Therefore, they carefully go around the edge of it. When you get too close to the center, they change the subject. And if you get very close to the center, they may go into hysteria. But they will not tell the truth unless, over a period of years, fatigue is so great that they have no longer energy enough to lie with. Then they may tell the truth. But each person knows these problems without telling anyone. And if they correct them, there's no need to really to have any people know that you had them. But if you don't correct them, they're going to know whether you say anything about it or not. So it is very important in all of these problems to really go to work on yourself and use the faculties which, as Buddha pointed out, you have been given in order to search out the meaning of yourself and realize that in the center of every problem that you face is yourself. And that if you're able to correct this situation, if you're able to find out the mistake you are making and have the courage, strength, and dedication to correct it, you will find life is much easier, health is much better, and you will have many more friends and many more opportunities to grow and be happy. These are the things that we are all going to have to learn one of these days. Oh, thank you very much.